it's probably just running late. So I'll officially kick us off. Again, we have a small group here intentionally. This is the Northeast region of America. We have folks on from the Business Council, the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry, the Maine State Chamber, eventually Delaware, and possibly Massachusetts. So I'll go ahead and kick us off. This is one of four quarterly regional economic forums we're going to be holding in the next 2 days for council members. And it's a real pleasure to introduce Ted Abernathy. Ted is our COSC National Economic Advisor. You probably saw Ted's background. We announced him, I think, in the last couple weeks in our Monday morning memos. Ted has a unique background. He's worked in economic development for over three decades around the country, often but mostly focused on southern states, headed up the Southern Governors Growth Policy Organization. But in his new role as the principal of his own company, Economic Leadership, he's probably worked with, I might get this wrong, Ted, but maybe a dozen different state chambers across America on economic data, information. He's kind of become the go-to guy for a lot of states that want to get a good feel for economic trends, economic information, and it's just a good source of intel. So we're really grateful to have Ted jump on and be part of the council team for 2020. And with that, Ted, I'll turn the floor to you. And format for today, Ted will present 30 or so minutes of slides, time for Q&A at the end. And I think if we're lucky, we'll wrap this up at noon and we should be good to go. So Ted, welcome, and welcome to members of the council. Thanks for being on, and Ted, look forward to your remarks.
Thanks, Lou. I have been lucky enough, I think it's 11 state chambers that we've done major projects for now. So looking forward to trying to be part of this. What we try to do, our company, and Lou refers to it as a new venture. I think we're in year eight now, so we're kind of been there a little bit. We try to help states look at their competitiveness and then look at strategies and best practices around the country that they can beg, borrow, or steal to try to improve that. So today, what Lou asked me to do is sort of an economic reset. Where were we as we came into COVID? What do we know so far? And then the second half, what do we expect to come out the back end of it? We've been doing these for businesses about 40% of our work is for businesses and the rest for chambers or economic development organizations. Lou asked if we could divide it up into regions of the country. And so my initial cut was to use the census version of what regions are. So for today's call, we'll change that for the second time we do this to match the group that's on the call. But for today's call, just Mike's not on yet, but Delaware is stuck in the south in the census data. So it's in the Delaware is not in the Northeast in today's data. So we'll make sure, Kathy will make sure that you have access to all the slides as we go through. So we're going to look at sort of four regions. I think we get to do the Midwest today and then the other two tomorrow. And as all of you know, we came into this year, we were at 113 straight months of growth. It had been the longest expansion in the country's history of private sector job growth year over year. And then in April, we lost 20 million jobs. And the chart looked like this on the top, but if you scaled the 20 million, it actually looks like that. It's a crazy chart, and pretty much every time you look at economic charts from now on, 2020 is going to look a little odd. We did bounce back and added 2.5 million jobs last month, which was the largest job growth in a single month in our history. And next month, we expect those numbers to continue their way back up. The real question overall is going to be how much of the job losses that we initially took are going to become permanent. We'll talk about that as we get to the end. The May to May numbers, the job totals have been across the board about a little under 12% total job growth loss nationally, 40% drop in leisure and hospitality. We closed up. The good news is that a lot of those jobs will come back as we reopen. The bad news is until the consumer figures out that they're comfortable going back to entertainment venues and restaurants, those are going to probably lag. The area that got impacted the least was the financial services sector. In fact, you'll see some places it actually grew through this as it was distributing PPP money. So overall, pretty broad-based as we go in. If you look at the four regions, they were impacted a little differently. The Northeast region, and I think probably because y'all were early in the COVID-19, your leisure and hospitality growth on a May basis is almost 60%. It's huge. And as you reopen, that should heal pretty quickly. But each of the regions has been impacted differently. You'll notice the May to May numbers, the South, they're the red bar in here, impacted a little less. They didn't close up quite as quick. A lot of places stayed open. And so now you'll probably see a bounce in June of the South numbers getting a little worse while other places start to heal a little bit more. Just looking at you guys in the Northeast, compared to the national average, you can see you took hits pretty much across the board. Government sector about the same, but everything else a little bit worse than the country. That's the early entry, I think, for COVID-19 and the big impact in New York City as it plays on the region. But overall, pretty broad-based. Nationally, every state's taken a hit. Nationally, we lost 11.7% of jobs. You can see a few of the states, places like Utah, only dropped 5%, whereas Hawaii dropped 20%. So it was uneven through May, and that's part of the confusion we have nationally with all of our governors doing different things, is that the real impact was felt very differently around the country at different times. The national media sort of homogenizes all of that when they just talk about the country, but it has been a pretty uneven hit early on. These are the four regions, again, Northeast the most, South the least through May. And if you look at your individual states, everybody in the Northeast took a deeper hit than the United States across that period of time. So New York, the biggest, and because they're the largest state, made a skewed impact on it. But the Northeast came in real impactful in the first few months. Let's back up a bit, though. COVID is a hard slap for everybody, but now I want to step back, and we'll do some of this each time on different components that we talk. But this is the growth in jobs over the last 5 years for the four regions of the country. Midwest lagged the overall. Mostly the growth, the biggest growth has been in the West and the South. This is just average annual jobs. Everybody growing, but at different rates. This is your states. So state with the most growth number, Massachusetts, then New York, New Jersey. Connecticut had the lowest growth rate along with Vermont. Everybody grew, and that's a good thing. We were in a good time in the national economy, but it was a mixed bag. So for instance, Connecticut grew at 1%, Massachusetts at 8%. Those are very different parts. So while we'll aggregate you in regions, we understand that everybody's economy is very different. And if you look at the regions, this is the regional growth over the last 5 years by type. So look at the long green bar up there. Construction in the West has been booming, jumped by 30%. If you go down as their population, you can see their health and education also grew. That's the 17% and the green down here. I mean, big growth in the West. And I think for some regions, I think that growth in the West is probably a bit surprising. I think a lot of people thought the South was growing faster, but it has not been for some period of time now. The trade, transport, and utility sectors, and especially the manufacturing sector, where there was just very little growth in the Northeast, are areas worth considering. The professional and technical services, on the other hand, you grew at about 10%. So it's clear that the economies are different from region to region, and how they grow is different, and between states. This is the gain by sector of the Northeast compared to the country. You can see overall just a lag in the Northeast on raw numbers of jobs. You're a much more mature part economy. You're not an economy that's adding new things on a regular basis. You're mostly sustaining, and you'll see what that does to other numbers in just a second. This is per capita GDP change for the four regions. And all of a sudden, the West is still the largest at 14.6%. But when you look at GDP per capita, Actually, the Northeast grew faster than either the South or the Midwest during that period of time. Now, you normally see GDP growth and for states, but states that are adding a lot of population, that's an easy thing to float up. GDP per capita is important because that has a lot to do with productivity and eventually wages, and you'll see those numbers. But the GDP per capita grew significantly in the Northeast over the last 5 years. And if you look at the individual states, Massachusetts, again, the highest growth rate, Rhode Island in this case, the lowest on GDP per capita. And then looking at the four regions, the change in per capita personal income, the West led again, followed by the Northeast. Incomes were rising seriously in the Northeast, much ahead of the South or the Midwest. Here's your personal income for the Northeast region over the last 5 years. Big jumps in New York. I know these are not equalized for cost of living, so in some places that makes a huge difference in this. But Massachusetts, New York leading the way. Rhode Island, the lowest in that period. And why that matters is if you look at productivity around the country, you look at million-dollar productivity, this is GDP per 1,000 workers, it's all over the place. When you look at the different regions, actual productivity output is actually the highest in the Northeast region. So your workers are producing more GDP per hour than the other regions. You look at your individual states again, high numbers in New York, high numbers in Connecticut and Massachusetts. And the reason that matters is that if you look at per capita GDP versus per capita income, you get, you map all the states. You guys are in the dark blue, so you see up at the top here, Massachusetts and Connecticut, New York. There is a straight correlation between the amount of output that your worker has and the incomes that your workers earn. So if you look down here at the bottom, a lot of lower cost employees in Mississippi and Alabama and West Virginia and Arkansas, but their output per capita is lower. So as you're looking as a business, you're looking at a lot of different factors, no single factor. And so we look at those productivity numbers, those output, what that does and what the relationship does. And then you're trying to find some correlations along the way. So again, everybody will get the slides. You'll be able to go through them, ask questions, do whatever you'd like. After COVID-19, we're all going to start preparing for whatever the next new normal happens to be. And the thing that I've been telling our clients is that after COVID-19, competitiveness still matters. If we ever get back to something that looks like normal, then a lot of the things that mattered on December of last year will still matter going forward. So the corporate studies always say these are the things that companies looking to relocate are paying attention to. So highways and labor and quality of life and all sorts of things related to cost and reliability. I think that one of the trends, and Lou's heard me talk about this a lot, is that data analytics are now available everywhere. And so we can do big data analytics on everything down to the census tract level around the country. If a company knows what it really needs, then you can figure that out. This is just a box that we do that looks at all of those places that rank states, the Forbes and the CNBCs and the chief executive magazines. And then we plot that against the actual performance of the economy in the state. So whether or not you're growing jobs, your wages are going up, your GDP is going up. And you can see down here in the bottom left, the green box, those are the places that they're reported as being good. The beauty pageants say they're good and they're producing well. So Florida and Texas and North Carolina and Nevada and Colorado. Up in the top are places that are usually ranked low and have not been performing well. But not everybody's in the boxes. So down here is Massachusetts. Massachusetts does better than it's typically ranked. Maine does better than it's typically ranked. New York does better than it's typically ranked. And so performance, what it would tell you is that everybody's not using the same set of metrics to determine competitiveness. I'll give you a quick example. Here's the, and sorry about this, Lou, I know you're a tax guy and like it. This is how high corporate taxes are in your state. And so people like that a lot. And Certainly as chambers, your business leaders like that number. Here's the correlation of taxes and performance. Not much. There's no straight number. So what it says is not that taxes aren't important, but that taxes are important and labor is important and, you know, and infrastructure is important. All sorts of things are important to a company. So we try to track as many of those individual factors as we can going forward. So with COVID, what gets to be different? So there are state economies that are exposed differently. WalletHub did something this past week that looked at how economies are structured, what it is that they have that makes them more or less susceptible to both the virus and the impacts. So you're starting to see this. I think this one's okay, but people are starting to understand that the virus impacts us all differently. Better, the Center for Economic Policy Research internationally looks at the industries that are most likely to have a shock to them, both in supply and demand. So down here in the corner, entertainment and restaurants, clearly the demand was reduced and the supply has been hit. Up in the transport area, energy, car usage, car production, it's been hit hard, mostly as a supply shock. And then a lot of places, though, once the virus wanes a little, they're going to be back to almost normal because there hasn't been an overall demand and supply shock. That's industry. When you look at occupations, you map all the occupations, and down here in the corner are the ones that, so this measures the demand and supply shock on the axis, and then the color tells you how high the wages are for the individual things. You look at the places that are having negative shocks, you can see cooks and dining rooms and dishwashers, all that should make sense. We closed up businesses, they're in trouble. You look all the way down there, gaming cage workers and musicians and lodging managers. There's a whole bunch of occupations that took a huge hit. Most of them are lower wage. If you look at the higher wage occupations, there are a lot of them that can be done from home, so they have not been hit. So as we come back, it is the people who were already taking the lower end jobs in society that got hit. And that, from a policy standpoint, that gives you a lot of things to think about. Whether or not those people will come back to work, whether or not sustained support for them will discourage that, whether or not those jobs will actually be there, because those are the jobs that are also most susceptible to automation. There's a lot to be thinking about on the occupational level. We've always seen as a trend that we were in constant disruption, and we know that our companies and our occupations have been in disruption, but think about what just the last 3 months. I mean, Amazon's added 175,000 new workers. Grubhub has doubled in size. Airbnb has imploded the other way. American Airlines is laying off people after having an almost record year. The accelerated disruption is going to impact different industries very differently. Just as a simple example, if you look at retail, just sales, Amazon's up 22%, Target's up 11, Lowe's is up 11, Walmart's up, but Macy's is down 45%, Nordstrom's down 40%. We're having a disruptive resetting of our marketplaces. And companies, we saw yesterday, you know, one of the top energy companies for that was a darling 10 years ago, then beginning the shale, go into bankruptcy. So a lot of disruption. A lot of your companies are going to have that type of disruption. We were having talent wars before this started. We'll have them when we come out. The skill sets that we were all looking for, we won't have any more of. In fact, some things might be exacerbated. Healthcare industry was having trouble with specialty nurses. The odds are a lot of people aren't going into specialty nursing on the other side. We were having trouble with machinists and robotic engineers and those things. Well, as we increase that, those are going to be even less quantity than before. And the quantity, we were all struggling for labor because we were at record low unemployment. Well, so we've got a lot of unemployment now, but as we come out of it, the question is how many people actually come back into the labor market? Our labor force participation rate is going to start to drop because, you know, mom doesn't want to put Jane and Johnny back in school because they're scared, or grandma needs to stay home because the nursing home wasn't safe, or keep naming it. We think that the labor market will contract pretty significantly, and we're all going to be struggling again. So your businesses that were worried about labor are still going to be worried about labor. And this is forever because our growth rates for labor force are at record lows. We're not having children. And there was a question, at least I had a question going into COVID, is whether or not this would increase babies in the future because everybody was stuck at home with nothing to do, or would decrease. And the projections are that people will probably have between 500,000 fewer children this year than would be typical. And what would have been typical would have been the lowest year in our history. So we're going to be struggling for labor for a long time. We've obviously contracted immigration labor coming in. All of those are going to make workforce and talent one of the headaches that chambers and their members deal with for years to come. Are people going to move out of the big cities? People typically look for safety and health and housing and education as a place to live. They also look at where they can find a job or their spouse can. There's not a lot of real good data that says everybody's going to move out of the big city. People were leaving some large cities before this started and moving, you know, into their halo metros maybe or nearby. But, you know, the data was actually that cities over 1 million over the last, since 2010, had contracted some. Places between 100,000 and 1 million had all the net growth in the country, but places lower than 100,000 were dropping the most and are likely to continue to do that. So some mid-sized cities might find a big advantage out of this. Maybe people will think twice about international gateways, but I doubt that too much changes overall. Remote everything's going to rule the future. More people are going to remote work, more people are going to telemedicine, more people are going to exercise at home rather than a gym, and they're going to not go to the movies as much, they're going to bank from home, they're going to have their groceries delivered. We have taught an entire baby generation how to live online in the last 3 months. People who never banked online or never went to the groceries online, unlike their children who are already doing it, now have learned how, and lo and behold, it's easy and not that difficult, not that scary. And yeah, we'll go out and shop a little bit, but expect everything remote to continue to grow. Telehealth is one of those that probably just made a huge jump. There are people who are predicting that we shaved 5 to 7 years off of telehealth in its its accumulation over time, that we may have made the jump below 10 up to close to 30%. So whether or not you can go to the doctor online and get your prescription and do all of that, we've got some sorting to do between healthcare and insurance companies, but it's just one example. Robots will rule also. We were already trying to put as many robots into manufacturing as we could, but the service industry, the retail industry, the home healthcare industry, the senior care industry, if you have a robot that does something, it is not subject to a stay-at-home order and it does not get sick. So expect a huge explosion in robots as we move forward. This is the chart of the jobs that were going to be automated, most likely up here in the right corner. These are office and administrative and food prep and production and sales. Remember the people who were laid off earlier, that's a bunch of those people. Companies are going to figure out as fast as they can how to replace as many people with automation and robotics as possible. One that we are not talking about in such ways, but one that we have been talking about to our clients for about a year is what is beginning to happen with a global geo-muddle. We were talking about Brexit and the South China Sea and Hong Kong and authoritarian rule, but we weren't talking a lot about the tech decoupling that's happening, the fact that China has as their new policy to have standards that are different from U.S. company standards or U.S. standards. We are looking probably at trade and other global things that are much different going forward. Globalization dramatically slowed right after the last recession, 2008. The expectations were that globalization and global trade would follow that dotted line. It didn't. It dropped down to that blue line. And now we're up here at this 2020 mark, the expectation might is now 30% or more foreign trade drop this year. And it interesting question to see how much will come back, because I think we all assume that there's going to be some reshoring of U.S. supply chains. A lot of opportunities for reshoring or nearshoring by pharma, medical devices, defense industries, lots of mining things and food back. And whether that's nearshoring into Mexico and Canada or reshoring into America is yet to be seen. But most major companies are looking at how to make their supply chains both redundant and shorter. If you look at the four regions, you guys are the least dependent on export of goods per capita, but you still have a strong export market in the Northeast, and how we export things is going to be impacted. If you look at the, it's not a state in the Northeast is actually to the national average, but some states pretty high on what they export, and this is goods. You also export services, and it'll be an interesting question on our trade deals going forward, how the goods and services are treated. We have a lot of rejiggering to do to our trade deals, and it'll be 2021 will be an amazing year for globalization. The Small Business Pulse Survey that the Census Bureau started, they started it in April just to see what was happening. And at that point, 90% of small businesses said that they had been either severely, largely, or moderately negatively impacted by the virus. We hear a lot today about those companies that have found a way to make it work for them. But the positive numbers are now up to 4% of small businesses. Not very encouraging. So yes, if you go out and try hard, you can find some good stories. But by and large, COVID has just been a disaster for small businesses. Numbers are all over the place, but 20% to 40% permanent loss of small businesses are generally what people are talking about. I think it might be at the lower end of that, but I don't think we're going to know for a couple years, because some really damaged businesses are going to make it back to opening, but then might not make it from back after that. We have seen some positive in durable goods manufacturing, a little bit of a comeback. The big hit in durable goods was around transportation, so aerospace, automotive, and that has not come back as much. So we'll keep our finger on the pulse with NAM on what's going on with the manufacturing sector. The income and spending is interesting. We were cruising along in January, February, and then in March, our spending took a big drop and our incomes of people in America took a little bit of a drop. In April, incomes went way up because we sent checks out to people, and unemployment insurance with the federal bump on it for a lot of people in the targeted occupations that we talked about, the unemployment with a $600 boost and a $1,200 check actually raised their incomes. But we got scared and we started saving about 33% of everything we made. And so spending went down. We've loosened spending up this past month, but overall incomes are now back down because the check stimuluses aren't there. And so when June comes out, it's going to be interesting to see if we've gotten back to spending a little bit more of the money. The data suggests that low-income spenders dropped quickly, but came back, and they're only down 4% in their overall spending. But higher-income individuals are still down close to 20%. So higher-income individuals are still hoarding their money and waiting to see what happens. The goods and services that they buy are the ones that right now are taking the biggest impact. The key to recovery is going to be the sentiment of consumers as a consumptionist society. Consumers have to feel better. Good news for you guys is your Northeastern consumer confidence has come back pretty quickly. The response to COVID-19 early on worked in a lot of places in the Northeast. You went through some tough times, but things look like they're back on the way up. You can see the Southern sentiment came up and then is flattened back out through last week. And we get the next week, I don't think it's going to go up. I think you're going to see a little bit worse on that. But overall, we need consumers to feel good about themselves to go forward. The real question for all of us and care about business is that future consumer behavior. Right now, and there's an old rule that ambiguous information does not give people a way to rationally decide what to do. And we currently have ambiguous information. So consumers aren't going to do something that would be rational or smart. So where they live or how much they save or how far they travel to work or whether or not they're going to take a vacation is completely unknown right now. You're going to have an individual consumer tell you that because they're not sure what to do with the information they have. And then if you think about this forward, the scare is one that a lot of people were voicing last year, which is, will there be a moral change in the judgments of economic policy? A lot of chambers last year, and people were concerned that people were there was an anti-capitalism movement. Well, that has turned a little now, and there's a, you know, whether we prioritize growth and efficiency, and I don't think efficiency is going to be it because we're talking about redundancy. Now we're having discussions all over the country on equity and opportunity and universal access to health and housing and whatever it happens to be. So keeping our finger on the pulse of how the consumer is valuing the economic uncertainty out there is going to be a real, priority for chambers as we go forward. Businesses know they have a global pandemic. They know there's a global recession. They know that both local domestic politics and geopolitical politics are out there. And now with the polarization and some of the equity discussions, all of that just combines to create a huge amount of business risk. You're going to see a lot of your big members very reluctant to make major decisions or anything going forward until some of that risk starts to settle down. So, you know, with a little luck, the pandemic we find a cure for the virus or a treatment for the virus coming up, and this cascades through. The last group of recessions took a long time to settle out. The 2007 was about 6 years before we got back to the jobs. Everybody's trying to figure out U-shaped, V-shaped. I mean, I think we're going to have a big V for a lot of jobs. I think you're going to get back to 95, 96, 97% sometime relatively quickly as soon as we have a virus that is out of stage one. But then it's going to take a while because small businesses take a while to replace. Big businesses will be a little hesitant. The Congressional Budget Office is suggesting that right now it looks like 11 million of the jobs might be lost permanently. And at the rate we grow, that means full recovery isn't here until the end of the decade. So, a recovering time, but a slow recovering somewhere along the way. In future months, we won't go through all the old stuff with you guys, but we're going to take a look at educational requirements for future jobs as one of the issues we'll try to bring to you. We're going to look at tech employment growth and where it's been, where it's going by sector. We'll dig down one quarter on that. We'll also look at some of the relationships between crime rates and poverty rates and how some of the stuff that people are talking about are reflective, you know, in here. Since you're the Northeast and my friends in New Mexico aren't on right now, you can see that New Mexico has a very high violent crime rate and a very high poverty rate. And there's a correlation that goes through these things. So we'll be looking at some of those things that economically can be correlated, things that might be interesting. So every month, every quarter, the goal will be to give you a few highlights, some things about your economy and how it's looking, but also try to pick out something each quarter that looks a little different, might give you a little different look. At least for me, thanks to Lou for letting me participate in this. We'll try to be as helpful as we can to everyone. And we look forward to working with you. Happy to answer as many questions as you might have.
Great.
All right, I'm going to stop the sharing there and back to you.
Thanks a lot, Ted. Always a lot of information. We tried to pack a lot into 30 minutes, and Ted has another 30 minutes he could go if we let him. But how about some questions for Ted? Obviously, we could circle back to slides if need to, but let's just go ahead and open the floor up to anyone with a question and
or a comment or a prediction. I'd love to hear somebody else's thoughts too. Yeah.
This is Heather Brichetti, Business Council of New York State. I'm curious if there's a takeaway, and I know this is a quarterly update, so things will change over time, but is there something that we could be recommending to our state to really focus on to accelerate the jobs recovery? I mean, it looks to me like some of the hospitality sector jobs are going to be slower coming back. Certainly the airline industry jobs, I think, will be slower coming back. But is there something we could be asking our state to focus its policy on rather than just taxing the wealthy, which is where their attention is right now?
Yeah, so I think that I think there's a couple sectors that are national importance and really going to take a hit. I have no idea when everybody's going to feel comfortable getting back on airport planes. We do some strategic plans for airports, and one of the airports I work with, they're doing plans right now to assume that they don't get back to their 2019 passenger counts for 10 to 15 years. So there's a report came out last week that they don't think there'll be a new plane built, except for, you know, very specialty stuff for commercial use for a decade. So shoring up industries that are your biggest contributors in your state is one thing. So I would figure out, you know, are there specific industries that you can help any way possible? One. Second is there are going to be a lot of small businesses that churn. So I don't think any of us believe that if, you know, 700 restaurants on the Lower East Side close, that some group of the space won't come back as restaurants. They'll happen there or something else. But trying to help small businesses have whatever buffer they can have makes some sense going forward. I think that for a couple things to look at downstream, the supply chain reshoring is going to be important to existing businesses more so than just talking about it as jobs for the country. If you can reshore things that shorten the supply chain and make it more efficient for existing businesses as recruitment targets instead of going out and trying to build a new industry, recruit the suppliers or help the suppliers move to New York that are part of your existing business. That's one. The other is change the rules and regulations to allow your workforce certifications and retrainings to get much shorter. People are going to have to get back to work. Some of their jobs are going to be gone. So you want short-term certifications. You want anything that blocks a community college or whatever, whoever's doing workforce for you, anything that prohibits them from doing it faster, quicker, accepting some other state's certifications, anything that'll do that will help you churn it back in. So that's a few, but there are obviously a lot of things you can do to try to help.
Hey, Ted, could I go back to your slide on those industries that actually benefited mm-hmm. during the pandemic? Other than personal mm-hmm. injury lawyers, who else falls into that category?
Right now, banks do. Banking and financial services are doing pretty well because they're doing workouts on that. The industrial and manufacturing real estate market's doing really well because we're short on that. Anything that has to do with electronic communication, anything that has to do with tele-anything, so telemedicine organizations, most health is doing okay. First month, it did bad because we cut out elective surgery. Since then, health has come back, and there's a lot of demand on that. So as I said before, not a lot of, we have more examples that are anecdotal of businesses that have benefited. But within in the area, the one, for instance, everybody knows that Amazon's doing well. You might not know that Target's doing well. What's getting killed are the ones that were weak before it started. So those are some examples. Zoom's done pretty well through all of this, if we are any indication, because they sure seem to be every day all the time.
Ted, represent the Maine State Chamber of Commerce. So in looking at your slides, obviously I'm interested in what's happening around the tourism-based economy. In Maine, of course, it's a question that is receiving a fair amount of discussion. And I mean, I think there are a couple of things. Some people in the industry will want to say, well, because we have a 14-day quarantine requirement or a testing requirement, it's going to keep people from coming here. But I think the larger question is, even if you took that away, would people still have the disposable income willing to come to Maine and stay, or any tourist destination and stay in the current economic conditions? And in looking at your slides, that's sort of what I was thinking about. The fact of the matter is, you know, some of the deeply rooted, very popular tourism destinations in this state are just decimated right now. And a lot of places just are never, some of these businesses are just, as you pointed out, the small businesses, they're never coming back. They're not.
Correct. Yeah. I think that if you said a quarter are never coming back, that would be a conservative guess. I think there's a lot. Good news for you, I think, in Maine is many of your tourist destinations are outdoors. They're natural places. They're places that, you know, don't have a lease, so they're not going to lose their building. I think that you're going to see a little bit, at least in the next few years, movement toward that type of tourism more so. I would be real concerned if I was running a casino.
We only have two there.
So I mean, or you know, if you were don't take the pictures to be any contradiction to this. I mean, right now I'm on a coast in North Carolina. We think that there are record crowds at our beaches. I'm not sure it's particularly smart, but they're ridiculously number of crowds, and only a third of the restaurants are fully open, and they can only have a third of the people. Most of them won't make it. They're built on a season that's only 4.5-5 months. They have to run full blast to pay their bills. So there are going to be change.
There was a story, and I mean, Maine is surprisingly enough a very foodie state, and Portland is one of the most popular foodie destinations in the country right now. It's the restaurant and the lodging groups that are taking the hardest hit because, you know, you can't, you know, in some places, I was on a conference call where one large hotel on the coast said last year we were 68% occupancy. This week at the same time we're 6, and you know that's not a successful business model.
Yeah, I think that you're the people holding the notes on these places. The banking industry is going to play a key role in all of this as we move forward. How lenient they're going to be, whether everybody's just going to take a time out for a year and go forward. I think one of the keys for you going forward for all of us is, though, that we don't do something, that we don't make it worse as we come out of this, that we don't start passing too many laws that are about redundancy. And I don't mean it's, you can't be perfectly safe in every business all the time. We actually are doing safety studies for two state chambers right now in different parts of the country. Every industry has safety issues. And you measure those, you weigh your risk. But if you do enough stuff as a knee jerk, when a legislature comes back in, when they think something started forming normality, and all that does is just push everybody over the last edge they have, then you're going to have the recession or the rebound or the recovery or whatever you want to call it, it's going to be pushed further and further out. And so for state chambers, keeping a really close eye on what your legislature is thinking they do to make things better and how much that's going to impact your companies, I think it's going to be a really key role for your legislative staffs.
Hey, Ted, this is Ken Pekulski from the Business Council. I had to drop off for a minute, so if you already answered this, I apologize. But when you talk about the sectors that are, you know, doing well, is that based on just receipts, or do you have any, is it based on headcount, or is it based on, I wouldn't imagine you have a whole lot of data on profits yet.
Yeah, headcount. There's no profit data. Yeah.
Because one of the things that we hear,
the least.
Yeah, particularly from some of our retail members, is that those increased sales are being offset from increased operational costs too, as you do the various safety upgrades.
Yes, and that's actually part of what I was saying. And, you know, when you come back, let's say that we just, things go great and people come back to 90%. We did a analysis for one of the state chambers on if you got back to 95%, what would that mean? And the answer is it means that things aren't really, really good. It'd be great to be back to 95% today, but you're still well below what it takes to be profitable. So a lot of small businesses, they're eventually going to get reopened, but consumers aren't going to behave the way they were behaving in 2019, and that's going to create a gap in their ability. And Kenz, I agree with you completely. The profitability becomes the echo impacts over the next couple of years. People who can operate but can't operate to the profitability they need will be the next round of problems.
Can I ask a quick question? It's Pat Bailey from the Business Council. You mentioned casinos. I was just wondering your thought on that and what you meant by them. We have a couple that are in the area.
Casinos were used as a place where lots of people packed together. So with just one example, Disney World's another one. It's hard to have the operating margins for lots fewer people. It's also hard to get people to believe that coming back and packing in is safe. So indoor worse than outdoor, but anything that's packed is going to be really hard to get a consumer to come back to in the numbers that gets you back to where you were before. And so, you know, most companies don't have monstrous profit margins. And so when you start shaving them, you get into dangerous territory really quick. So that's all I meant by casinos.
So Ted, what do you see? I mean, obviously the data you're talking about lags a little bit. I think according to what we've heard over the weekend, about 30 states are seeing their numbers for COVID kind of go in the wrong direction, including North Carolina and some of the folks on the call here. What do you think that means to maybe the next time we're talking in terms of impact?
Lou, and Lou knows this, but for the rest of you, I spent part of my career working as the chief operating officer of the Research Triangles Economic Development. So I have a lot of friends in the pharmaceutical industry and drug industry. I have to do the first part of that, so it doesn't really sound as bad as I just said the second. What scares me is that we don't know much. The scariest part about COVID for me now, business-wise, is that we still don't know enough to make anybody feel comfortable. And so I think that we're in for a little bit longer slog of uncertainty. Uncertainty creates risk, and businesses, you all know how much they despise risk. So my concern is more about not knowing than it is about, you know, if we run through the whole population and end up with, you know, a herd in 2021 and 80% of people had the virus and a zillion people died, it's horrible. We have no idea how to guess whether that's going to happen or something else is going to happen. We don't know yet if you can get this twice. We don't know yet if the second time, I mean, we don't know anything as best I can tell. And so we're going to have to just ride through. The question that scares me now is we are progressing with so much information that sounds like we know something that we don't, that the risk factors just keep going up. And when I talk to larger companies, their biggest concerns are two things, that the risk keeps going up because there's no certainty, and their consumer, as consumers get those mixed messages, they don't behave the way they're supposed to and are predictable. And so that risk continues to escalate. So I don't have any idea about the health side of it, but the business side of it, we have to start circling some of that risk into more information that's consistent.
Yep, good. Well, obviously the current political environment probably adds another can of gas onto already a not optimal situation.
I'd say that was fair. It's you know, and like I said in the presentation, I think the geopolitical, we're having so much fun, you know, watching tweets and you know, calculating every governor's point of view, we've probably got our eye off of a lot of international things that are going to impact us and a lot of our companies for a long time. So that scares me too.
Yeah, good. Okay, any further questions for Ted? I think we've got a few more minutes, and you know, Ted's very gracious with his time, and you know, I haven't asked him a question yet that'll stump him, but that helps anyone.
It's because one of my answers is I don't know, and you always seem to take them.
Hey, Ted, Gene Barr again. Let me go back to, and sure. you made a note of with something we've all seen, which is the increase in cases. But the one thing that seems to be at least a little bit different this time than 2-3 months ago has been, one, they tend to be among younger people. That we don't seem not to be seeing the hospitalizations. Houston may be one difference, but I think the thing, and we keep trying to tell people this, I'm interested in your perspective, let's make sure we don't see this rise in infection rates reverberate back to where we're slamming business shut again, because I think the thing to keep in mind is at the outset, we weren't told we're going to stop the virus. We were told that the key is don't have the surge that overwhelms our healthcare facility. So would you agree that there are some differences now in what we're seeing versus 2 months ago?
Gene, again, I'm not a health guy, but I think what you just said is correct. The original stay-at-home orders was so that we could buy ourselves the time to prepare for things we weren't prepared for, which is a surge at the hospitals, the personal protection stuff, the ventilators, all of that. And that was, had we, you know, at least the way I see this, had we all done exactly what we were supposed to do for 3 months around the country, we might be in a different place, but we didn't. And so the surge for me, every day it'd be nice to know how many people were tested, how many of them were asymptomatic, how many of them had this, but also how many people have been hospitalized, how many people have died of this, you know, and look at those kind of things. There's no doubt when you open back up bars, restaurants, and beaches that young people are going to surge. That's just life. And if we open up colleges in the fall, which many are going to open, then the surge number, and you decide you're going to test all those kids after 6 weeks, the surge will be ridiculously high. Now, again, if you can figure out how many of them got real sick, how many of them, you know, I've got an 85-year-old mother. She hadn't left her house since this started. She won't let anybody come see her. You leave stuff on the doorsteps kind of things. I think that's smart of her because she has pre-existing conditions and she's 85. But I think that until we have some consistency about this, we don't have closed borders. So, you know, somebody else having everybody stay at home and the state beside them having open beaches. I live 10 miles from the South Carolina border. For the longest time, I had a mask order and nothing was open, but I could drive 10 miles and just go sit down at a restaurant and eat, no problems, if I wanted to. It doesn't help either state to have people doing that. So consistency would be pretty good right now.
Okay, any more questions for Ted? Okay, well, again, thanks everyone for joining. Ted, again, thanks for being part of the Council of State Chambers team. I guess I always get a lot when I hear Ted talk, but I think Ted talk, I like that. You know, the talent wars continue. I think that's an interesting takeaway that just because the workforce dynamics are changing, you know, skilled workers are still needed. The migration from large cities, I think, is not a post-COVID phenomenon. It just continues to happen. I think the remote everything is probably another accelerated disruption, as is automation. And I think what we keep reading, and I think Ted kind of amplified, you know, the plight of the low-skill, low-wage worker is probably a really tough one and tough to fix, you know, without different and better skills. And what I think we're all living with, at least post March 12th or so, is ambiguity and uncertainty rule. So isn't it the Chinese proverb that says, may we be blessed to live in interesting times? So I guess we're plenty blessed. So thanks everyone for joining. And again, Ted's presentation, audio and visual, will be available to you to share with your staff, share with your members, share with however you want to take full advantage of it. It'll also be on the council website. So thanks for joining us today, Kathy. Thanks for making the technology work, and have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks very much.
See ya. Thanks, everyone. Take care.